Evening. I'm pleased to
Good evening.
welcome one and all to the continuing series, the summer teleconference series of the Commission on Torah Projects of Agudas Yisrael of America. Pleasure and honor to introduce Harav Ben-Tzion Schaefer.
Thank you. The Gemara tells us, Amar Yehuda Amar Rav, La'olam al yavi adam atzmo l'idei nesoyan. A man should never bring himself to a nesoyan. How do we know this? Because we see that's exactly what happened to David. David Melech Yisrael brought himself to Nisayon, and he was nichshal, he failed. And the Gemara explains to us what happened, the famous event. Amalafan of Ribono Shel Olam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Mipnei Ma Omrim L'kei Avram, L'kei Yitzhak, V'L'kei Yaakov. Why is it, as David of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why is it that for generations they're going to say, Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzhak, Elokei Yaakov, why aren't they going to say Elokei David? Meaning to say, David HaMelech knew exactly who he was. He was not arrogant. He was not in any sense of Al-Gaiva, but he was right up there amongst the Avos HaOlam. And his question was, why are they distinct? Why are they in a different group? What is it that Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov did that I don't have? Kadosh Baruch Hu answers them and says, they I tested, you I haven't tested. Says David Bechanani, Hashem test me. So Hashem says, fine, but I'm going to do something different. I'm going to do something for you that I didn't do for them. I'm going to tell you what the test is. The test is going to be in the area of Arias. The Gemara says it wasn't long then after that David was walking on the roof of his palace, and he saw something over on the edge. He looked well beyond, and it's not clear exactly what happened, but the Sutton arranged it as such that he should see Bathsheba bathing. He told his guard, bring me that woman. Halohi, isn't she Ashes Uriachiti? Isn't she a married woman? Bring her. And in fact, David Melch Yisrael lived with an Ashes Ish. Now he spent the rest of his life in tshuva and charata, and anyone who says David sinned doesn't understand. There was a tanai, and lemafreya she wasn't divorced. But at the end of the day, he failed his biggest nesayon, and for the rest of his life, he suffered. And if you'd like to know to what extent he suffered, read the words of Tachanun, Yagasi ban Chasi. My groans are so powerful I can't even withstand it. My bed is soaked with tears. He spent his whole life in pain because of that. So here's what I would like to ask as a very obvious, simple question. How did David HaMelech fall for the oldest trick in the books? David HaMelech was a Chassid Elyon. It's hard to imagine his Kedusha. He's certainly in the league of the Avos. The question he asked was, why did they say Elokei Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and not Elokei David? But more than that, let's in fact say he had some desire. He had 18 wives. There are plenty of ways for him to fulfill his desire. And if you don't really understand why this is such a powerful question, we have a minhag that after Shalashudas, we no longer say Good Shabbos, we say Guten, because there's a Kabbalah that was the time when David HaMelech was Nifter. But Chazal explained to us what happened. Hashem gave the Satan the job of killing David. The problem was that David HaMelech asked Hashem when he was going to die, and Hashem told him, I can't tell you the day, but the day of the week I'll tell you, and it's Shabbos. From that moment on, David HaMelech had a minhag. He would go out into the woods, and he would begin learning. With Kabbalah Shabbos, he'd start learning, and he spent the entire Shabbos in Kedusha and Tahara. And because the final day of his life, he was involved in learning the whole time, the Sutton couldn't touch him. And it wasn't all the way until by Mincha time, the Sutton realized the day is ending. If he doesn't get to work now, he's not going to accomplish his mission. He goes over to a branch, shakes it, makes some noise. David HaMelech looks up, and then that momentary lapse, the Torah was no longer mugging, and therefore the Sutton was able to take him. But what that means in plain simple language is, from Kabbalah to Shabbos, hour after hour, the man was involved in uninterrupted dveikus, learning and davening, totally, completely dovek to Hashem, to the extent that the Schus HaTorah was mugging, protecting him, hour after hour after hour. Finally, after the whole night, well into the morning, well into the afternoon, by Mincha time, the Sutton realized he better do something, and he shakes the tree. But until that point, it was uninterrupted, total amelus b'torah. So here's the question. Hashem tells him the Nisayan is going to be in the area of Arayas. He has 18 wives, and he's on the level of Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov. How is it possible that he fell for the oldest trick in the book? And I believe that this question is actually profound, and I believe it shares with us a tremendous understanding. And to understand the answer to this question, I want to share with you an observation. Have you ever heard someone say, "Oh, if only I had a Gadol's Yetzahara. Oh, if only I had the Yetzahara of Rav Chaim Kanievsky, oh, life would be wonderful." I would like to share with you that if I had Rav Chaim Kanievsky's Yetzahara, I probably would be a serial killer. And I'll explain to you why. See, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Adam, Hashem created something that's almost inexplicable, something called Bechira. But Bechira isn't something that's simple to understand. As an example, from the time you're a little child in Cheder, you were taught that a Malach doesn't have free will, right? Adam has Bechira, man has free will. A Malach, an angel, does not have Bechira, doesn't have free will. I'd like to share with you that that is patently false. Malachim have free will. The Rambam says they're Das Nifra, they're a separate intelligence. They have complete free will, just as you and I have free will. If you'd like to understand the difference between Adam and a Malach, it's actually a little bit more complex. Imagine the following. Imagine I pull out a $100 bill, and I say to you, this $100 bill is yours if you put your hand in a fire for 1 minute. Right? Here you go. $100. All you have to do to get this $100 is to put your hand in a fire for 1 minute. Would you take me up on that offer? The odds are very, very slim. Why? Because it's foolish. It's self-inflicted damage. No one's going to put their hand in a fire for a minute for $100 because it's utterly ridiculous. It's going to damage me. Here's the problem. A malach sees with absolute clarity the results of every action that it does. And a malach understands that every mitzvah that Hashem gave is for the betterment of that individual as well as the entire Bria. You know why a malach would never sin? Because it sees with such clarity that every commandment that Hashem gave us is for its good. And it sees the damage that would be wrought if it didn't listen. So does a malach have free will? The answer is it does, much like you have free will to put your hand in a fire. Would you put your hand in a fire? No. Do you have free will to do it? In theory, you would, but you never, practically, you would never do it. And that's the kind of free will that a malach has, but that's not the kind of free will that we refer to when Hashem created Adam. When Hashem created man, it was with free will where it was just as easy to go to the left as to go to the right. For Adam to be the one who's responsible for that choice, for responsible for making himself into what he is for eternity, it had to be just as easy for him to go left, to go right, to be a tzaddik, to be a rasha. But to do that requires a very tremendous change. To allow man to actually be tempted and to allow man to be different than a malach, Hashem took a neshama and put it into this body. This body has its own set of desires and appetites. It's called a nefesh abahami, and the I who am speaking to you am made up of two diverse parts. Part of me is a neshama that's pure, that's holy, that comes from right under the kisei hakavod, and part of me is the nefesh of the behemoth, the nefesh of the animal soul, with all of the desires and appetites and hungers as every other animal in the animal kingdom. If you go into the animal kingdom, you'll find that every single animal there has all of the appetites, desires to keep itself alive as well as to bring about the next species. Hashem invested into the animal soul of every animal all of the instincts that it needs to keep itself alive as well as to continue the species. Hashem put a very similar nefesh, a nefesh abahami, into man. And that is the part of man that has desires and appetites, and that is the part of man that hungers. That's a part of man that's programmed to keep man alive. But the I whom speaking to you am made up of two competing diverse parts. A neshama that's pure, that's kaddish, that's holy. A nefesh abahami that's pure hungers and appetites. And the I who think, the I who am the occupant of this body, am made up of these two diverse competing parts, and I'm ever confused and ever changing because these two parts are fighting for primacy. Each is demanding its fill, each is demanding its needs, and whichever one I listen to becomes more potent, more powerful, more dominant. Much like a muscle with use, it becomes stronger, with disuse, it atrophies. The more a person listens to his neshama, the stronger it becomes, the less of a sway the nefesh abahami has, and it grows and grows. On the opposite side, the more he gives in to the nefesh abahami, the stronger it becomes, and the more animal he becomes, more animalistic, until eventually his neshama has almost no sway. But these two parts are ever competing, ever vying for primacy. And that, with those two parts, Hashem gave Adam real, legitimate Bechira. Now when I wake up in the morning, there's a real sense within me, let's go, I want to grow and accomplish, I want to do great things. And there's a part of me that says, I couldn't care less. When I'm davening, I know that I'm speaking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu right here, and there's another full half of me that denies Hashem's presence or existence. And the I who thinks, the I who occupy this body, am ever in conflict, ever these two parts fighting, ever in this constant, constant battle. This allows for Bechira, this allows for real free will, because now if I actually shape myself into what I was destined to be, I'm credited with that. Why? Because I fought the battles, waged the war, and I am responsible and rewarded for what I did. And the opposite, if I cave, if I give in, I again am responsible because I could have resisted. But as now, the Adam has the ability to choose and be held accountable for his choices. And this allows for Bechira. However, it still leaves one little problem. What happens if at a tender young age, a person begins listening to his neshama and only does what's right, what's good, what's proper? What happens is the neshama becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, and the nefesh abahami, animal soul, becomes weaker and weaker. And eventually, within a short amount of time, if a person only listened to his neshama, he'd be a tzaddik gomer. His neshama would become stronger and stronger. Nefesh abahami would have less and less sway. And within a very short amount of time, there would be no reason for him to be on the planet. You see, if it ever gets to the point that there's never a challenge, if it ever gets to the point that there's nothing pulling me the other way, then I have the same free will as a malach, and in that state there's no growth, in that state there's no reason to be here. And because of that, Hashem created another feature. And there's one more feature that Hashem created to allow for actual real Bechira and allow that playing field to ever be equal. And that force is a malach, is the Satan. It's a powerful spiritual entity whose job it is to always keep an even playing field. So let's imagine a person starts at 50-50, right? Meaning his neshama is at a level of 50, his nefesh abahami, animal soul, is level 50. At that point, the Satan, that malach, is allowed very, very little control. Why? Because already the playing field is pretty equal. But if a person grows a little bit, let's assume he listens to his neshama, and he becomes, let's say, 60-40, at that point, the Satan is allowed more control. Why? Because he's allowed to even out the playing field, so he's allowed a little bit more control. Let's say a person grows more. He gets to the point where his neshama is 70 and nefesh abahami is 30. So again, the Satan is allowed even more play. Why? Because again, to keep an even playing field. If a person gets to an 80-20, so again, the Satan is allowed more and more. And if a person gets to 95-5, the Satan is allowed a tremendous amount of leeway and pressure. When Chazal say, Mishagodol mechavero, one who's greater than his friend, Yitzro godol mechavero, his Yetzahara is greater, it doesn't mean his animal soul is greater. A man spends his life conquering his animal soul, it's not stronger. What Chazal are referring to is the Satan, meaning to say, if a person becomes a real tzaddik, and he gets to the point where he's 95% neshama, and only 5% nefesh abahami, the Satan is allowed such control. He's allowed so much shlita. Why? Because he has to make it an even playing field. And if I were given the Yetzer Hara of Rav Chaim Kanevsky, again, I probably would be horrible Russia. Why? Because to face against a Sultan at that strength, the vast majority of humankind cannot even begin thinking about it. And this understanding is an important understanding in terms of the ability of Sultan. Hashem always allows for it to be equal, to be even, and allows it to remain as a constant battle. But we have one more step that we need to focus on. There are different forces in this world that often can give you an illustration to spiritual forces. In the physical world, there's something called electromagnetism. An electromagnet is a piece of metal that gets, you put electricity through it, and it becomes a high-powered magnet. If you ever gone to a junkyard, and you'll see overhead this sort of conveyor that moves back and forth, and when the fella turns on electricity, you could see an entire car jump off the ground onto that conveyor, and then he'll carry it over to the other side of the junkyard, back and forth. He's able to pick up thousands of pounds of metal by turning on electricity because the power of electromagnet is so strong that it pulls with such a powerful, powerful force. If you've ever gone for an MRI, you may note that their fire extinguishers in that building are never made out of metal. An MRI is a high-powered magnet, magnetic resonance imaging, and basically on a cellular level, they're moving the molecules, and it has to be such a powerful electromagnet that it literally pulls on that level. And one of the dangers of an electromagnet of that strength is that if there's anything metal in the vicinity, it'll grab it, and if you had a metal fire extinguisher on the wall, it would literally, like a missile, shoot out and smash right into that MRI machine, and anything in between would get crushed. Hence, if a building has an MRI in it, they don't have metal fire extinguishers. And electromagnetism is a powerful force that is hard to imagine. If you'd like to understand Pshat in this Chazal, I believe it's really quite simple. Hashem was saying to David, you want to test on the level of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov? You want to test on the level of Akedah Yitzhak? I'm going to allow the Sultan out of the box. Normally he's very controlled. Normally he's held in great, great check. I'm going to allow him total control. Go for it. Let's see. And David Melech Yisrael, the Gibor Chayil, against this Malach, against this powerful force, was putty in the hands of the Sultan, and that's why he failed. Could he have won this and saying, I guess so, maybe sort of like if I could climb Mount Everest barefoot? It was such a powerful electromagnetic force, such a powerful pull, that it was almost impossible to resist, hard for us to even imagine that strength of magnitude of the pull. And again, as great a man as David HaMelech failed, and the reason that this is important to recognize is because it's an illustration of different forces and different powers that Hashem puts into the world at different times. And I think this has some great relevance in our day and age. It was a number of years ago when I took my kids to the zoo, and I made an interesting observation. The animals inside the cages are not wearing clothing. But that doesn't bother me because they're supposed to be naked. It was the people on the other side of the cages who were also not wearing clothing that bothered me immensely. People run around today like Adam and Chava before the Chet. But I'd like to share with you that it wasn't that way in this country. In the 1920s in America, there were such careful codes of conduct, and the average person dressed with such dignity. All you have to do is look at advertisements from the 20s, and you'll see the average woman is wearing sleeves down to her wrist, skirts down to her ankles. It was considered vulgar for a woman to show her ankle in public. And the average woman in the 1920s in America dressed far more tznius than our frumos Beis Yaakov teachers do today. But that is not the world we live in. But if you look back, not even that long ago, surely within a 100-year span, you'll see such a stark difference. Lane Bryant began as a maternity where they would manufacture women's clothing from when they were pregnant. They wanted to take out an ad in the New York Times. The New York Times refused. A picture like that in the New York Times. It's not respect. We can't have a pregnant woman, an image of just, it's not respectful. Today, that's not the issue with the New York Times. And what you see is such a stark difference from a Puritan society to totally out of control. And it's even hard to illustrate because it's such a dramatic difference. And the counterculture revolution of the 1960s changed the entire face of the, certainly of Western civilization, and turned everything around to the point that men, women no longer wear clothing, and any sense of dignity, any sense of self-respect is gone. And the question you have to ask yourself is, how could it be? You see, the founding fathers of this country understood that this kind of situation isn't really very healthy. Divorce in America is at such an astonishingly powerful rate that the family doesn't exist anymore. And the idea of a family being raised, children being raised in a wholesome family environment, and they're beginning their life in a good, solid way, almost doesn't exist today. And you have to recognize the fact that it's not healthy. It's not good. And if you turn on a television today and you see the amount of, you'll excuse my nivel peh, but on the congressional floor, these words were stated. It was stated as follows. The average child today will watch thousands upon thousands of acts of cohabitation. Now, what a child is doing and watching a man and a woman being together is very, very questionable. But that's not the strange part about this. And again, these words were said on the floor of Congress. The average person watching TV today will see thousands upon thousands of acts of cohabitation. Only 1 in 7 will be between a husband and his wife. Do you understand what I'm saying? Imagine you have 6-year-old, 7-year-old Peter, Sally, and Bob are sitting there watching thousands and thousands of acts of cohabitation, but only 1 in 7 is between a man and his wife. The rest are between, I guess, a man and another wife, a man and a man. I don't even know, and I don't care to know, but I have to share with you that I do not believe that it's healthy for the psyche. I do not believe it's healthy for the emotional development of little Peter, little Sally, and little Bob to be exposed to this stuff. And if you'd like to see the result, just look what society today looks like. Just look what the family looks like. What you're looking at is the destruction of Western civilization, and the results are scary. And to appreciate how fast the turnaround is, in the 60s, in the Midwest, there were rallies. There were rallies where they burnt Beatle records because the fathers, the mothers, said this stuff is abhorrent. Do you understand? They have lyrics in there about, I want to hold your hand. And they burned in public the Beatle records. Why? Because it was just too damaging. That is not what's on the airways today. The FCC began because Herbert Hoover recognized that there was a tremendous need to protect the average citizen. In those days, it was the radio. The radio could be broadcast, and it was a danger that any individual could get out there and present all kinds of thoughts. So the Federal Communication Commission began for the purpose of protecting the average citizen, protecting the men, women, and children from hearing things, eventually seeing things that wouldn't be to their benefit. And yet, that's how this country began, but it's not where it is today. And what passes for normalcy today is abnormal. What passes for regular today is so out of range that you have to say to yourself, what's pshat? What's going on? And if you'd like to know what's going on, it's really quite simple. There aren't many Nishonas left in our generation. If a person wants to learn, there are many, many yeshivas, many, many programs, many, many opportunities. A person wants to daven, you have a host of minyanim. You want to keep kosher? Absolutely. You want to keep Shabbos? There are laws that will guarantee you cannot be fired from your job. It's very, very easy. However, there has to be a balance, and I believe that Hashem has given the Sultan unbelievable amount of shlita, of control. And if you'd like to see it, it's the insanity of the current situation. The current situation is destructive and damaging. Forget religion. Forget God. We're talking about being a wholesome human being, being married and being happily married. I do not accept that you can possibly be happily married and satisfied with your wife if all day long you're being bombarded by beautiful women and attractive women all day, every day, time after time, time after. It just no longer works. And they say that the average citizen of our country is bombarded by between 1,500 and 5,000 marketing messages every day. Many, if not most of them, have some element of promiscuity, some element that's improper, and it is absolutely insane. Again, forget religion, forget the Torah, forget Hashem. It's insane because it's destructive to society. It's destructive to anything that's wholesome and good. And if you'd like to understand it, it is insane. But again, I believe it's a Maisa Satan. The Satan's allowed out of the box because that is the fight of our generation. And all of this, of course, is before we even discuss the internet. I sincerely believe that if you took the Gedolim of Sodom v'Amora, take the most depraved Mushkosim of Sodom v'Amora, put them in front of an unfiltered internet portal for 30 seconds, they'd fall on their faces in humility. We thought we were Gedolim. We were nobody. You guys are Machadish, such Chedushim in Ashkosim, destruction. What you can see in 30 seconds on the internet is so damaging that it's hard to describe. I believe this Chazal shares with us an eye-opening understanding. And that is, it's not just me, and it's not just desire. There's a Satan. Hashem put this force in the world. Hashem wants us to succeed. And if a person battles, Hashem gives them siyata d'shmaya, and a person wins. Exactly as Mesillas Yesharim says, me against a Satan, I would lose. There's no hope. But if I do what I'm supposed to, and I daven, Hashem helps, and slowly, slowly I win. But you have to recognize that the battle is fever-pitched. You have to recognize that when you walk in the streets of Manhattan, it's not normal. It's insane beyond insane. And you have to recognize that this is a Maisa Satan, and you have to recognize the strength of the battle, and obviously what the rewards are, because Hashem would only give that kind of battle if the rewards, if we can win, and the rewards are that great. I want to thank the Torah, Rabbi Pearl, and the commission for putting together this program. Much shatzlacha. Thank you.